Hello and welcome to the Trainspotting 2 minicast from Big Mouth. Beware, this is going to be absolutely heaving with spoilers for the film. So if you haven't seen it yet, stop listening right now because you'll only have yourself to blame. Okay, are they all gone? Right. With me, Andrew Harrison, and our producer, Matt Hall, we have Miranda Sawyer of The Observer. Hello, Miranda, how are you?
Hello.
And Will Hutchinson of The Times. Hello, Will.
Hello.
And we all went to see T2 the other night, as it's annoyingly called, on a fantastic Tuesday night film club, and it was great fun.
So
firstly, were we surprised by the treatment of the characters? We can actually talk about what happens to the denouement and how, you know, particularly the one that stuck out to me was how Spud, who's been this comic foil in the whole thing, turns out to have been Irvin Welsh all along. He was a writer. He was writing it, you know, within him he had all the stories.
Yeah, I had a problem with that.
Yeah.
So I had a problem with Spud and Begbie. Okay, so I didn't at the beginning,
yeah.
And I thought the bit where Renton meets Spud and essentially saves his life was absolutely great. I mean, really beautifully shot, fantastic kind of, you know, kind of metaphor of him falling off the top of a building. It was great. And then him being sick was also really brilliant, really hilarious. It's a great scene. And, you know, Spud was the one that we... You love Spud. Everyone was absolutely, you know, you can't help but Spud. But there was a couple of things that happened to him that just didn't sit right for me. One was, you know, when he's coming off heroin. And if you think about what happened in the first film, the coming off heroin was a massively kind of weird, trippy sequence, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you just get a little bit of Spud sitting in the corner kind of going, feeling a bit rough while everyone else is enjoying themselves. And then he miraculously turns into this writer, which is okay, but it's a bit twee, I thought, actually. It's a bit twee. I mean, I know that you want Spud to succeed, and this seems like the only way he can succeed, but I found that slightly twee. And Begbie, I have a massive problem with, because Begbie just became some kind of horror show character where he was just stalking Renton. That's what he was doing. He turned into something that was not human at all.
He loves violence.
Yeah, to be fair, he wasn't exactly, you know, Mother Teresa.
No, he wasn't. But that kind of... He was a bit more tricky than that. He wasn't as one note, is what I kind of felt. And so a lot of them were, you know, I mean, Sick Boy and Renton particularly were very tricky characters, weren't they? And they were lucky enough to keep that trickiness. And I found that Begbie just turned into this kind of thug who supposedly then had a, you know, kind of revelation about his kid. That was quite cliched. And Spud became something else. It's halfway through, it just went off on this tip that I thought wasn't real. Well, I mean, I know it's not real, but...
I mean, there's certainly an element that, like, in a film, in a film world, in the original and the first half of the movie, which is effectively about losers hanging around, suddenly it gets gripped by a story and they get propelled.
Yeah, and I don't want a story.
I quite liked the story. Well, what do you think? How it played out with it effectively turning into Begbie is going to chase and kill Renton.
No, I actually quite like that. And the other thing, but also I felt that I'm not in total agreement with you because I think Robert Carlyle is just such a really good actor.
Yeah,
he is great.
And I thought
the way
he portrayed it was just fantastic. So it's, you know, I still had that thing, which, I mean, what Trainspotting was great, the first Trainspotting was fantastic because you had that fear that you get at 2 o'clock in the morning in a chip shop when the guy walks in, you go, okay, this could go really bad.
And it's your mate.
Yeah, and that was still there. And of course you still get guys in middle age like that. That's what Begbie's like.
Yeah.
So yeah, in a way it was, but also even the son thing, I mean, yes, the son was a little bit ridiculous. You know, they made it fairly obvious. The son's a nice boy. He doesn't want to follow his dad into violence. And it's the reversal of the usual father story where the son does something wrong and the father wants him to do the right thing. But I didn't mind any of that. I more felt that it became a little bit like the Spice Girls movie or something.
A bit of a caper.
Yeah, like a bit of a caper, you know. It's, you know, quite a lot of... often, you know, everyone says that White Teeth is a brilliant book. It is. The second half is basically a caper of people running around London, you know, and it's a little bit like that with Trainspotting. It's like, this is a really great, serious story, issues that you're dredging up about where, you know, where lives go and how you continue to have meaning and what youth is and maybe blah, 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 all that stuff. But it just becomes this kind of crazy caper where everyone goes, okay, need to make everything tie up, otherwise it doesn't really make sense.
But I actually really like that. And I like the fact that in Trainspotting 1, you know, Begbie is just a psychopath. He has no interior life. He just loves violence.
He does.
And that is that horrendous scene where he just tosses a
pint
pot,
so
glasses a girl,
scene.
And then runs downstairs and says, somebody just glassed a lassie, just for an excuse for a kickoff. It's fantastic, but I love the way, actually, Trainspotting 2, it doesn't humanise him because he's still a monster, yeah. but you at least get to see a little crack inside to find out why he's such a monster. But more than that, you also see how irrelevant he is now, because his world of glassing people in pubs is gone.
That's a really good point.
His son's world of, you know, hotel management.
Trying to do the right thing.
Trying to do the right thing.
And also, because it's not going to be very easy. So, you know, there's not going to be any fallback. So his son's got to find a way to make a living. Thought that was really good. But also the other thing that was really good, slightly, a kind of a storyline, which was, I thought was quite brave, actually, was the fact that he can't get it up.
Yeah.
And I thought that was great because, you know, here's this hard man. He's meant to be, he's practically a walking penis.
Yeah.
And there he is with his wife. He's been in jail for 20 years.
And he can only raise a smile after indulging in extreme violence, which is clearly motor of his character.
Yeah, and half a dozen Viagra,
but they're not having any effect until he starts
that, even that doesn't work.
Yeah. But it's also, what's interesting, it must be really hard to make these films because essentially, if you're trying to do it off Irvin's words, which you are, really, essentially, they're quite hard because they are Irvin's writing, which I really enjoy, is quite often just a series of amazing scenes. So that kind of Catholic scene where they sing is just fantastic, and that's it's just brilliant. I was howling at that, but that's an Irvine Welsh short
Catholics.
Story. Yeah, but you know what I mean. There's a series of little stories from Irvine that they're trying to work in, and so because they're all just amazing set pieces, it's quite hard to make a kind of story.
But
out
what's
of it.
what Irvine Welsh is very good at, and what the best points of both of Danny Boyle's films are good at, is showing little scenes of life which most people will not know about.
Yeah.
So I didn't really know. I mean, I knew the Celtic versus Rangers Protestant Catholic thing, but I didn't know that you'd have these pubs where they would sing about the wonders of killing Catholics.
You need to see the film No Surrender, which is just...
You need to live with a Northern Irish Catholic.
No Surrender, which has got a little...
Can I do neither of those things?
It's like that. No Surrender is like a two-hour version of that scene in Trainspotting 2, and it's fantastic.
And that's a brilliant scene.
Yeah.
It's completely great. I mean, there's the things like that I really loved.
Because
really
that's people's
loved
lives.
And I loved the bit where Sick Boy and Renton get together and they start ranting at each other and excluding the girlfriend, essentially. And that bit where they just stay up all night, it's just that's beautiful.
How do you feel about the fact that there was such... I found myself very distracted and quite kind of upset from the point of view of not liking kind of it when old bands get back together and when it kept on showing bits of the original film and then doing that, but also alluding to other bits of the original film.
Yeah. It was a reunion concert film, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly that. And that's why the first half of it, I really didn't enjoy it. And then the bit about... I take your point about Begbie, but the bit about where his kind of emotional... realization that his life was something which was impairing his own son and was a result of his own father.
See, I don't agree that it was a reunion concert because I think every single quote, visual quote, musical quote, echoing scenes, like the great bit at the end where you see Renton strike the same pose that he did in the first movie, he's out to pass out from smack and actually he's not, he's playing a record. Lots of echoes are in there. But the tone is all of great regret and wistfulness and sadness.
The fact that he couldn't put that track on at the start of the film, nice piece.
Yeah, and, you know, a reunion concert is when a band comes on stage and says, hey, we're as great as ever we were, back together again, and, you know, fortune's in, here's something new album.
Yeah, but that's the whole point. That's the whole point. In the band's heads.
Yeah.
But they don't.
They know they're not. I mean, I agree with Andrew, actually. You're seeing these things. I mean, sometimes it was overplayed, I thought, because I think if you're very familiar with the first film, which you probably will be, then you don't need to completely see him laughing over the bonnet.
Because
you know it. It's kind of there and it's in your head. And I maybe would have liked to seen it just touched a little more lightly. But I agree with you because what they're doing is, of course, they're living those things anyway because they're back seeing each other. You're going to remember.
Well, that's essentially what this group of characters is about. They are stuck. They're trapped in the past. And you mentioned in the main podcast, Miranda, that the women are kind of appendages.
Yeah, I think very hard.
Particularly Veronica, the young, you know, Sick Boy's young prostitute girlfriend. And as we now know, because we've all seen the film, the denouement is that she does to them what Renton did to them in the first film. She takes off with the money with the connivance of Spud. So there's an echo there. But to me, I actually think it's in a way better than the denouement of the first movie because she's youth. She's going places and they're not. They're just stuck in the swamp of their...
Yeah,
which
just,
isn't even heroin. It's their own inability to get a grip.
I agree and I understand that as a kind of, you know, as a device. It's just as a middle-aged woman, you get pretty sick of being replaced by, you know, young prostitutes. You know, essentially, you know, that's the kind of problem with it. You know, and I can see, you know, I absolutely agree. She wins, she gets the money.
Yeah,
that's absolutely great. But still, it is irritating to have actresses of the fantastic caliber of Kelly MacDonald and Shirley, can't remember her surname, and you know, they're not used properly.
Well, I was really looking forward to when Kelly MacDonald's character appeared. I was thinking, oh brilliant,
it's going to be great. They're she's going to be involved. Yeah, it'll be precisely. Really good.
And then all that she did was going, she's too young for you, and that was it. It was like they've got off for half a day. You
I thought that was perfect actually, because she in the first movie was going places. She was not going to stay in this mire with these losers. And the you know, Sick Boy, Rent, and Begbie and Spud are friends who hate each other and are stuck with each other. She, you know, she could not have been part of this movie. You know, if she'd been brought in, as you just said, to come in and try and sort out the legal problems, that would have become a real artificial caper. She doesn't want to have anything to do with them. She's moved on. She's got another life. And I don't think that's to in any way denigrate the character.
It happens so often that you get really bored of it. You know, I mean, it would be, you know, and I understand it's a male film, and I like male films, you know. But, you know, there are a lot of, most films that are offered to me that I find interesting are male films, right? Yeah. That's fine. I'm used to it. It's great. You know, there was an advert for Free Fire. You know, that is a brilliant film. I've seen it. It's got, you know, it's got one woman in it.
Yeah.
It's a great film. But you just get sick of it. You just get really sick. And all your favourite films to be replaced by, you know, the person who's kind of representing you, to be replaced by a younger, fitter, sexier version is boring.
But to be honest, though, I mean, Sick Boy is called Sick Boy for a reason. He's a morally degenerate individual.
Yeah, he's great. I love that character.
He's great. But he is not going to take up with a thinking,
sophisticated, agree,
smart,
but
great woman.
No, I absolutely agree. But there's a way that the plot can go. You can bring people. There's no reason why Shirley Henderson shouldn't have been in it more. She was just in and out, wasn't she? But and I understand why. It's just boring. It's just boring for a person to watch over and over.
But, you know, but actually she could have been in it more, because her relationship as Spud's kind of ex-partner with Spud, and he was going there quite often. He went to get the photographs. Yeah. He went to kind of give her the manuscripts of his stories. You know, there could have been interaction with her rather than her just kind of sat there reading a load of fool's caps and not
going,
saying anything.
Yeah, going, well done, Spud, you've done it now.
I don't know. I think she kind of gives him permission to break out of his life. You know,
plus,
like
can
I
just point out, sorry, I know that and a lot of female friends on various bits of social media have gone, oh, great, Ewan McGregor's got his kit off again. I probably have never thought, and I don't think, that any ex-heroin addict, no matter how long they've been off the smack, can look as good as Ewan McGregor does in that.
But Ewan McGregor just looks great.
He's been in the gym for 20 years in Amsterdam. Yeah, exactly. He's been working out.
He's been preparing for this very moment.
Yeah.
Sick Boy has been on the cocaine, hasn't he?
He's not really bloated enough, is he?
No, precisely. Although I do like the scene with him doing his hair.
Yeah, that's very funny.
The peroxiding his hair.
I also like what Ewan McGregor said ages ago, which I really like about him, as a kind of pro-woman thing. He said, women are always being asked to take their kit off on film. I just take my kit off. I don't care. So like in the films that he's in, he's quite happy to be naked. And you notice that when he's in bed, you know, with the lady, you don't see her at all. You just see him, because he's just quite happy.
His ass.
It's like, everybody's always looking at women. Here I am. Whee!
Yeah. And there's gambling gaily through the glens, Boy and Renton, some, you know, asked for the viewers.
But I do think that Ewan Bremner is certainly kind of the heart of this film. And he does look like somebody who's been on smack for 20 years, which is great. And his speech is brilliant, the kind of way that all his teeth have fallen out. But his physical comedy is just fantastic. There's one point where he comes into a room kind of looking like a worried tortoise, where his just neck extends and it just keeps going, and the rest of his body doesn't follow. It's really, you know, it's brilliant.
He's at the heart of the film, isn't he? Yeah. He's very appealing.
Yeah. What do we make of Irving Welsh's cameo?
Oh, Jesus.
It's always the same. Irving can't act, and he is Irving. I won't hear a word against
Danny him. Boyle and the cast were on Chris Evans' show on Radio 2, I think, last week, and somebody asked that question, and Danny Boyle said, you know, God love him, he's a brilliant writer, but the genius of his writing is inverse proportion to the his capability as an actor.
Because as a person, I mean, he's a great person, but he has a game face. So you talk to him and his face doesn't change. He'll be saying something completely outrageous or completely funny or really touching, and his face doesn't change. I mean, that's how he talks. And so for acting, that's not that brilliant.
Well, you know. Ryan Gosling's got by on it, hasn't he?
Oh, God, yeah, he's rubbish, isn't he?
Can't act out of a paper bag. So just finally, the final scene, and I mentioned it a minute ago, was Renton's back in his room. He's back in his childhood bedroom. He's reconciled with his dad, but the trains are still on the wallpaper is still there, and he puts Lust for Life on, and the whole thing kind of vanishes into this infinite time tunnel kind of thing. I found that really very poignant, because the film encapsulates pretty much the last moment when people could lose themselves entirely in music, because there was nothing else left, nothing else around to lose yourself into. There wasn't a world of social media and multiple avenues of entertainment. There was literally records and nothing else. And that's the kind of world that Renton's gone back to. He's gone back to his bedroom.
He has, but I also found it massively frustrating, because that version of Lust for Life
is being
remixed by the Prodigy. Yeah. And it's turned into this kind of big beat thing, which actually sounds like the wrong mix between dated and not like the spirit of the original. So for me, it didn't work at all. Like everyone, I don't know anyone who doesn't love Lust for Life. Yeah. But the original version is so funky. Yeah. You know, it's got such a groove. And this one doesn't have a groove, it's just got a sledgehammer. And I thought, no, please don't do this.
Do you think that might be an incredibly subtle meta comment by Danny Boyle? Let me complete the thought before you train-splain it away. I think it's a clever meta comment that Renton really doesn't know what's going on anymore. As they say in the first film, when you lose it, you've lost it, and you never get it back again. And Renton's a guy who thinks Big Beat is still great.
But that's a bit like saying, yeah, I know, I wrote this novel, and it doesn't make sense. Didn't you get it? That's the point. You know what I mean? It's a little bit like that. It's like, I just didn't think it's very good.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because actually, of course, you know, everyone involved doesn't know what's happening anymore. I mean, you know, Danny Boyle is a fantastic film director. Irvin Welsh is a great writer. John Hodge, you know, all these people are brilliant, but they're middle-aged now, so of course you shouldn't know. And so there's an element that, you know, maybe he does think that Prodigy mix is great. Maybe he doesn't. We don't know. But actually, he really might think it's great, and he's wrong. And there's nothing wrong with that, because he's middle-aged.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't really get it right.
It's how it goes.
Because, you know, this is not a movie about youth. The first one was a movie about youth.
Yeah.
And it performed that fantastic sleight of hand of showing you a horrible, disgusting world and yet still making it seem exciting.
Like Britpop. Yeah, it was the Britpop movie. And
And this one is about middle age, and in Begbie's case, late middle age, and basically the end of your active life. He ends up back in jail. There's nothing down for him ever again. And I thought there was a great poignancy to that, and I thought that it was beautifully well done, because I think the people who made the film, they understood youth when they were making the first one, and now they understand middle age.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, I think the material, the ideas, fantastic. Really, really good. But for me, again, the presentation was just too, it was too in your face. I felt that for a film which is about middle age, you needed just a bit of calm.
Do you think it was the filmic equivalent of a super dry jacket?
I can't think of anything better than that, so yes.
I think it's a lot better than that. I really enjoyed it.
You think it's a Jack Wolfskin, do you?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's a barber.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thanks for listening. And if your mates have seen the film, then please feel free to share this with them. And if they haven't, don't, or they will cease being your friends. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on Big Mouth soon. See you then. Bye-bye.